From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, two countries that are case studies in the war on terrorism, Yemen and Eritrea. After traveling to both countries, journalist Robert D. Kaplan wrote a piece called A Tale of Two Colonies, which is published in the April edition of the Atlantic Monthly. Yemen is believed to have the largest al-Qaeda presence outside of the Afghanistan-Pakistan region. Also, a new election in Turkey may mean that Turkey will reconsider letting Americans have a military base there for its troops. We'll check in again with Peter Galbraith about how this might affect the Kurds. And Fresh Air's linguist Jeff Nunberg examines the evolution of the word protest, as in anti-war protest and pro-war protest. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Bush administration is engaged in intensive diplomacy in an effort to save a UN Security Council resolution on Iraq from defeat. The U.S. says it would go along with a change in the resolution to give Iraq a little more time to disarm. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
Britain, which co-sponsored the resolution with the U.S. and Spain, has suggested extending the deadline for compliance by perhaps 2 weeks. The resolution currently sets a deadline of March 17th. But the undecided members of the Security Council, Pakistan, Mexico, Chile, Angola, Cameroon, and Guinea, are pushing for a more generous deadline of 45 days. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer says no.
The president thinks that there is a little room for a little more diplomacy, but not much time. Any suggestion of 30 days, 45 days is a non-starter.
Even if the deadline is pushed back to about the end of March, the resolution still faces a veto threat by France and Russia. Russia's UN ambassador, Sergei Lavrov, says any resolution that calls for the automatic use of force is unacceptable. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
Senate Democrats continue to block a vote on President Bush's nominee to a federal appeals court. Today, the Democrats rejected a GOP offer to hold another confirmation hearing for Miguel Estrada in exchange for an up or down vote on his nomination. The Democrats say they still want to see memoranda that Estrada wrote when he worked in the Solicitor General's office. They say Estrada has not been forthcoming about his views or his work history. Republicans say they'll try again to cut off the Democrats' filibuster on Thursday. The Bush administration is proposing to spend $1 billion over 5 years to improve testing of DNA for criminal investigations. It's hoped the money will address a backlog of DNA evidence in state labs. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
The Justice Department says that evidence and DNA samples from 350,000 rape and homicide cases alone are waiting to be tested. So Attorney General John Ashcroft says the administration is proposing more federal money to help those labs catch up.
It will allow us to conduct DNA analysis of more offender samples. It will solve more crimes through efficient and effective use of DNA improved technology.
Ashcroft says the money will buy equipment that allows automated processing of samples. The proposal will also encourage states to do more testing of criminals. Right now, only 23 states test all offenders. Other states only test violent felons. If approved by Congress, the funds will also allow better training of police and technicians so they can make better use of DNA evidence. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 44 points to close at 7,524 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 7. This is NPR News. Military officials say two people are known to have survived today's crash of an Army Black Hawk helicopter at Fort Drum in upstate New York. So far, officials have not released any information about the fate of the 11 other people aboard. Fort Drum is the home of the Army's 10th Mountain Division. A new study finds that a program that takes drug dealers out of prison and gives them job training does better at keeping them clean and at a lower cost than prison. NPR's Joseph Shapiro reports.
The program in Brooklyn, New York, targeted a difficult group, addicts who'd been arrested again and again for selling drugs. The Drug Treatment Alternative to Prison program allows dealers to plead guilty and then enter drug treatment instead of prison. But failure to complete the treatment means they must then serve the prison sentence. Participants also get job training, mental health care, and other services. Now a study of the New York program finds its graduates were less likely to be rearrested and more likely to be employed. And those results were achieved at about half the cost of keeping an addict in prison. The 5-year study was done by the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
The San Francisco District Attorney has dropped conspiracy charges against the city's police chief and a top aide. DA Terrence Hallinan said he couldn't prove that Chief Earl Sanders or his assistant chief, Alex Fagan Sr., obstructed justice or tried to cover up the roles of 3 off-duty police officers in a street brawl. That group includes the assistant chief's son, Alex Fagan Jr. The DA said he would prosecute the 3 as well as 5 other police commanders. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR online shop features a variety of merchandise, including the new series of music compilations, I Heard It on NPR, on the NPR website, npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Journalist Robert D. Kaplan has written an article about 2 countries that he describes as case studies in the war on terrorism, countries the U.S. is trying to work with, Yemen and Eritrea. Kaplan's article, A Tale of 2 Colonies, is in the April edition of the Atlantic Monthly. Kaplan is a correspondent for the magazine. He wrote an article called A Post-Saddam Scenario, which was published in the Atlantic's November edition. Kaplan's books include Surrender or Starve, Travels in Sudan, Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Somalia. A new edition will be published later this year. Yemen has perhaps the largest al-Qaeda presence anywhere outside the Afghanistan-Pakistan border region, and Osama bin Laden's family is originally from Yemen. I asked Kaplan if there's any estimate of how many al-Qaeda operatives are currently there.
Nobody has any numbers. Let me put it to you this way. When you travel, as I did, throughout the borderlands of the northern part of Yemen that abut the Saudi Arabian border, and I've even crossed in and out of Saudi Arabia from Yemen, this is an unmarked, unpatrolled border. In all of these towns in the area, you find just populations, huge populations of young men with assault rifles, the safeties off, radical preachers. The way to look at it is this is like a perfect petri dish, a perfect breeding ground for radicalism. And given the poverty of the country, the fact that half the country is 15 years old or younger, given that the central government has very little direct control in most of these border areas, makes it almost academic in terms of whether or not there's an al-Qaeda presence.
Well, in traveling through Yemen, did you get a sense of what popular opinion is about U.S. intervention in Iraq and also about bin Laden?
Well, what I learned in Yemen was that popular opinion in the Middle East, particularly in Arabia, exists on many different contradictory levels, and it depends what level you're tapping into. For instance, people will have the usual complaints about U.S. foreign policy. On the other hand, a Yemeni woman who has an American passport fetches a much higher dowry price, so that she's more desirable as a mate. Yemenis are constantly trying to get visas to study in the United States. Throughout Yemen, not just in Sana'a, the capital, but in the smallest outlying villages, you will meet significant numbers of Yemeni Americans, many retirees, people who've done very well in business in the United States and have retired back to the old country with their American passports, following American sports, proud of being Americans, kind of like the way Greeks retire back to Greek Americans retire back to Greece, etc. Yet at the same time, there's all this complaint about U.S. foreign policy, so that public opinion is very fluid in Yemen and very subject to events.
Now, Yemen has had 2 direct connections to terrorism. One, the attack on the USS Cole was in a harbor in Yemen, and the attack on the French tanker Limburg was off the Yemeni coast in 2002. You write, these attacks may have perplexed some Western observers. The bombings should have served to bring the U.S. and France closer together, but al-Qaeda knew what it was doing. What do you mean? What did al-Qaeda think it was doing?
Yes. At the time of the bombings, there was some questioning that al-Qaeda really didn't have a strategic sense, that it didn't really understand Western foreign policy and the power disputes within NATO, within the U.S. and Europe, because after all, it should have been in al-Qaeda's interest to split America and France apart. But these bombings were bringing them together. But al-Qaeda knew exactly what it was doing, and let me explain why. Think of Yemen. It's a country of 20 million people in the heartland of Arabia, very radicalized. It's a very culturally sympathetic, conveniently chaotic base for al-Qaeda. If only al-Qaeda could sufficiently weaken the Yemeni government so that there would be even more chaos than there is, and then al-Qaeda could operate. Because Yemen, remember, is not peripheral to the Middle East the way Afghanistan was. Yemen is Arab, unlike Afghanistan. It's a much more friendly climate. But here was the problem. Ali Abdullah Saleh, the president of Yemen, who's been in power since the late 70s, has built up a fairly strong institutional base of security services, police, ministries, etc. But one of the ways that that Ali Abdullah Saleh maintains control is that he's able to bribe tribal sheikhs. He's able to pay them off with oil revenues and shipping revenues that come through Yemen's main ports of Aden, and Makalla. Now, whenever you bomb an oil tanker, even if it's a small pinprick attack, suddenly insurance rates shoot up. Suddenly, ships don't want to come in and collect the oil. Suddenly, it's not just oil that's harder to ship and which insurance rates go up, but the whole container traffic in and out of the country, the insurance rates jack up. So through a few relatively small attacks separated by a year and a half, al-Qaeda was able to triple or quadruple insurance rates and basically slow down the money flowing into the Yemeni government coffers, with which the President Saleh is able to bribe the sheikhs and thus keep control of the country. So if you were looking for your best way to, your best cost-effective economy of force, asymmetrical way of attacking the Yemeni government at the heart, it would be to bomb oil tankers.
Now, what about President Saleh? Has he been tolerant of the al-Qaeda operatives there, or has he been cooperating with the United States war on terrorism against al-Qaeda?
Well, it's a bit complicated. Going back 11 years, remember that Yemen was probably the most flagrant supporter of Saddam Hussein in the Gulf War of 1991. And it was a financial disaster for Yemen afterwards in terms of losing aid from Saudi Arabia and many other things. This time, there was a lot of kind of speculation and reports that Yemen was looking the other way when al-Qaeda launched its attack on the USS Cole. President Saleh has various elements of his own family that were playing kind of footsie with some of, who were very close to radical sheikhs, al-Qaeda elements. But after September 11th, the direct pressure from the Bush White House was so overwhelming that basically President Saleh has decided for the time being to have an alliance with the United States. And his attitude towards the United States is he treats us like another rebellious tribal sheikh. We're like another crazy faction in his country that he has to hold close to his chest so he knows what we're doing. Hold your enemies close. So we've provided him with help. And in return, you may remember there was the November predator attack of November 2002 in the desert about 100 miles east of the Yemeni capital of Sana'a. There was an attack by an unmanned predator aircraft operated by the CIA that incinerated a vehicle that contained several passengers, including Abu Ali al-Harithi, who was an al-Qaeda operative in Yemen, one of the one of the main operatives who is a specialist in maritime terrorism. And that successful CIA attack against a top al-Qaeda leader in Yemen could not have been done without the cooperation of the Yemeni government at the highest levels. So, in a sense, the Yemeni government has now bought a one-way ticket with the United States. And in return, it's getting over $20 million in aid to beef up its special forces, to allow it to be able to project power into these tribal badlands, also to build a coast guard, which it didn't have before, which it will need if it is to protect container shipping and oil tanking in its coastal waters.
Okay, so they're getting over $20 million. That's the carrot. Is there a stick to, you said that the Bush administration really pressured the president of Yemen. What was the pressure part like?
Well, as I heard it, it was very blunt. The president spoke as blunt to the president of Yemen as he does sometimes, as President Bush sometimes speaks publicly. He said to him, "You're with us or you're against us. You're a friend or you're an enemy." And remember that by siding with Iraq over the United States 11 years ago, Yemen suffered enormously financially. And it is through finances, through money, that President Saleh of Yemen is able to pay off these tribal sheikhs and bribe his continuation in power, so to speak. The military aid doesn't seem like a lot of money, but it can go very, very far in a country like Yemen. And what President Saleh has done by holding his enemies close, like these tribal sheikhs, like the United States, with this temporary alliance of convenience, is that he's drawn closer to his half-brother on his mother's side, a man by the name of Ali Mohsen Saleh el-Ahmar. Now, Ali Mohsen is a very complicated man. He has had very close links to the most radical elements in Yemen. But he's also a very capable, button-down military organizer, a general whose armored unit protects the capital of Sana'a, someone who was seen by the United States in the pre-September 11th period to be a kind of bad guy. But he's now been co-opted by President Saleh into this pro-American alliance of convenience. And Ali Mohsen Saleh el-Ahmar serves another purpose for President Ali Abdullah Saleh of Yemen, and it is this. It's that in case this this war in Iraq goes badly for the United States, President Saleh will be able to swiftly and credibly distance himself from us through the good offices of his half-brother, who has such good links with the radicals in the country.
The radical Islamists.
Yes. And this is where we get to the heart of the issue in Yemen, where Yemen is like so many other countries in the Middle East in this perhaps a week or two before war in Mesopotamia. It's that you have leaders like President Saleh in Yemen, President Ali in Tunisia, the King Mohammed VI in Morocco, President Mubarak in Egypt, and many others who are kind of looking at how this turns out in Iraq. And if it turns out well, they're suddenly going to be moving closer to their moderates. They're going to be opening up their societies. They'll be holding elections, perhaps. Whereas if things go badly for the United States, for the sake of their own political preservation, they may be moving closer to the radicals and the extremists.
My guest is journalist Robert Kaplan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Robert D. Kaplan is my guest. He's a correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly, and in the April edition, he has a piece called A Tale of Two Colonies, based on his travels to Yemen and Eritrea, and looking at the role that they're playing or might play in the war on terrorism. What's the government that we're working with in Eritrea? What does this government represent?
It's hard to categorize it as good or bad. Let me give you the positive ledger and then the negative side of the ledger. The positive side of the ledger is here you have a country and a city. The capital of Eritrea is Asmara, which is probably the safest capital city in sub-Saharan Africa, a place you can walk around at night with thousands of dollars in your pocket. Nobody's going to rob you. You don't have to lock your doors. And it's not because of coercion or secret police, because you don't see any around, where there's a degree of social discipline and stability that you simply will not find elsewhere in Africa, where all handicapped people have nice new crutches, where women run all of the shops and stores. It seems like a model society. But the reason it is so is because this is a society that fought a 30-year, a three-decade-long guerrilla struggle with Ethiopia. And the result was that it inculcated a social discipline so strong that the government almost does not need to crack down. Now, there's the negative side of the ledger. Probably the worst press repression anywhere in sub-Saharan Africa. Elections canceled several times. Arrests of dissidents, and even the arrests without charges or trial even, of several employees of foreign embassies, including the United States. Now, here's the rub. Here's where it gets even trickier. The president of Eritrea, Isaias Afwerki, has offered the United States deep water port facilities, air bases, to bomb anyone we want, anytime we want, anywhere we want. He's strategically placed at the mouth of the Red Sea, 50 miles from Arabia. And given the problems we've been having in Turkey, in other parts of Europe, if you're looking down the road 5 or 10 years, it's almost inevitable that the Pentagon is going to want to have a deeper and deeper military relationship with this government.
What's the place of Eritrea in the war on terrorism now, and is it a haven for operatives from Al-Qaeda?
It technically could be a haven because there are so many hundreds of square miles of unpatrolled desert, but it probably isn't because that desert is unlivable. It has no water resources, and the government in Eritrea runs a very, very tight, efficient ship. In fact, security for diplomats, for foreign diplomats, Americans, Israelis even, is easier in Eritrea than it is almost anywhere else in the region. Diplomats, Israeli diplomats even walk around without bodyguards. I mean, this is a place that is really buttoned down and safe.
You write, our military involvement with Eritrea and Yemen will mean political involvement in their domestic affairs. And throughout the ages, that has been the essence of imperialism. What are you saying?
What I'm saying is, like, what the United States likes to do is say, we want a military relationship with you, and to do that, you have to have reasonably good human rights in most cases. But otherwise, we don't want to get involved in your domestic politics. We don't really care about Eritrea's historic dispute with Ethiopia or Yemen's dispute over a few islands in the Red Sea with Eritrea. But I've got news for you. If we're going to be establishing military facilities in these countries, if we're even going to use them for launch pads for attacks in future years, simply by being there, we're going to alter the domestic politics of all those countries, and we're going to have to get involved. And if you look at what actually happens in imperialist systems, it's that the search for security leads to an involvement in all the neuroses of many foreign countries. For instance, we can't just be setting up these bases in Eritrea, as enticing as they seem, if we can't get our own people released from detention. Because though the people that were arrested from the American embassy are not American citizens, they're Eritrean nationals, the United States has a rule. We protect our own, even the foreign nationals who work for our embassies all over the world. So that it's impossible to kind of have a military relationship without getting the government to loosen up on its crackdown of dissidents and others. And then suddenly you're inside the murk and mire of domestic politics.
Tell me if you see this a few years or even a few months down the line, that we have, you know, military bases in countries like Yemen, or military cooperation from countries like Yemen. And a lot of the people of that country hate America for whatever the reasons are on their agenda. And then we have to deal with putting down dissent. And
yeah.
Then we're kind of cracking down on the people of another country, or helping that country's government crack down on dissenters, putting us in a position that's the opposite of helping humanitarian concerns and human rights.
You know, I lived for 7 years in Greece in the 1980s, when we had four sprawling military bases there that were the bone of contention in domestic politics. And one of the reasons they were very unpopular, in other words, and one of the reasons they were unpopular is that they were very noticeable. One of them was in the heart of the Athenian suburbs. One of the things we're learning is something that the Soviets learned in Eastern Europe throughout the Cold War, when they had bases in Hungary, but nobody in Budapest ever saw Soviet soldiers, was that you have bases in outlying areas, outlying islands, places where they're simply not physically noticeable, where people don't necessarily see American troops.
Well, I'm just wondering, listening to you talk, do we want to be learning lessons from the Soviets and how to have bases in countries that don't really want you there?
Well, we don't want to be learning moral lessons from them, but in terms of, you know, here and there, some kind of tactical element. I mean, you know, establishing bases is pretty much standard around the world. Let me say that having bases in Eritrea would not be unpopular. In that sense, the Eritrean government is representing a popular wish. America is very, very popular in that country, so there wouldn't be the kind of contradictions that you're bringing up in Eritrea. Yemen, of course, would be a completely other story, and that's why I don't really see that we're going to have bases in Yemen. What we're going to have is hopefully a pro-American government that moves further and further towards, you know, human rights, democracy, along, you know, building up the society, and we'll have a very subtle, low-key military cooperation with us. That's the hope. In other words, keep President Saleh in power so that he can gradually extend the rule of law to the tribal badlands so as to bring humanitarian and social aid to these outlying regions, to get at the root of the problems in the first place.
Robert Kaplan's article on Yemen and Eritrea is published in the April edition of The Atlantic Monthly. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harcourt, publisher of The Ticket Out, Helen Knode's debut crime novel, a noir mystery set in Hollywood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, journalist Robert Kaplan on a scenario for a post-Saddam Iraq. Also an update on the Kurds in northern Iraq with Peter Galbraith. And linguist Jeff Nunberg looks at the evolution of the word protest, as in anti-war protest and pro-war protest. Mm-hmm. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Robert D. Kaplan, a correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. His article about Yemen, Eritrea, and the war on terrorism is published in the April edition. In an earlier edition of The Atlantic Monthly, you have an article on a post-Saddam scenario for Iraq. Can you just kind of give us a summary of your hopes for Iraq after Saddam Hussein?
Yes. My hopes are this, is that immediately after, we will have a kind of liberal dictatorship or a more liberal dictatorship along the lines of Parvez Musharraf in Pakistan or Hosni Mubarak in Egypt that will prepare the country for democracy further on. A kind of normal military dictator after a Stalinist dictator. A kind of transitional government for a while. Because to me, that is the only practical transitional alternative. You're not going to go cold turkey from a Stalinist system to a Western-style parliamentary democracy in a matter of a few weeks or even a few months. That was tried in Russia, and it led to financial collapse. What tends to succeed is gradual transitions. And remember, not all dictators are alike. There's gradations. There are distinctions. Saddam Hussein is in a class by himself. So that any new dictator along the lines of President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali in Tunisia, for example, President Mubarak in Egypt, almost any other ruler in the Arab world would signal a vast improvement in human rights in Iraq.
So we topple a tyrant and then support a dictator in his place.
We topple a Stalinist tyrant and replace him with a liberal-minded, liberalizing dictator as a temporary solution to prepare the groundwork for democracy, which is not simply holding elections, but building institutions. Because it is institutions that are the real centerpiece of democracy. Anyone can hold an election, but getting police, law courts, bureaucracies to function and be driven by something other than fear takes quite a while.
Now, a point that a lot of people have raised is that what has held together the different religious and ethnic groups of Iraq is the fact that it's been ruled by a tyrant, Saddam Hussein, with an iron hand. And the comparison has been made to what might happen after Saddam Hussein is toppled to what happened in Yugoslavia after the end of communism, which was that there was civil war, there was, you know, terrible fighting and terrible chaos. It was really quite ugly. Do you think America will be in the position of having to back somebody with a really strong arm in order to prevent that kind of chaos? And again, is that the position we'd want to be in?
Both Yugoslavia and Iraq came into being after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, and both suffer many of the same pathologies. It wasn't just Saddam who was a ruthless tyrant. All the Iraqi dictators before him were significantly more repressive than dictators in other parts of the Arab world, which means there's something about Iraq and its borders that goes beyond Saddam that is partly responsible for these high levels of repression. And the something is this. Not only do you have different ethnic groups, Kurds smashed together with Sunni Arabs, smashed together with Shiite Arabs, but it's that you also have an urban civilization in, among all these groups, fairly high levels of education starting in the 1930s and 1940s, and that has led for each of these groups to have a very well-articulated sense of national identity, which means in order to rule all three, it's required an iron fist. And therefore, because we are going to have to prevent the unleashing of chaos in the immediate aftermath of any successful military operation, we are going to have no choice but to go for a new leader, at least for a temporary period, who will be able to control things, who will be able to administer things.
In your piece on what a post-Saddam scenario might be like for Iraq, you write, the most logical place for U.S. to relocate Middle Eastern bases in the 21st century is Iraq. What kind of military presence do you envision the United States having in a post-Saddam Iraq?
All right. Well, look at it this way. Whatever you may think of the regime in Saudi Arabia and of our relationship with Saudi Arabia, the fact is that significant numbers of American troops on Saudi soil, that is the soil of the Holy Land, where the holy Muslim holy places are, is a provocation that hurts our bilateral relations with Saudi Arabia. It's destabilizing for the region. So we are going to have to relocate those troops whatever happens in the future. And Iraq is next door. It's in the heartland of the Middle East. It has, in addition to having a very repressive tradition, it also has a very secular tradition that is very deep and goes back many decades. And winning a war in Iraq, that is to say, you know, for the sake of argument, if this goes well, by definition, that's going to mean that we're going to be able to a certain extent over time to help remake society there. And we will, at the very minimum, have basing rights. We already do in the northern third of Iraq. Remember, the no-fly zones already are the equivalent of having basing rights in much of this country.
Do you think that that scenario fulfills one of the fears of a lot of people in that part of the world, which is that one of the reasons for this war, so we could have a more of a military presence there? It's about us. It's about our needs.
Well, all nations, including ours, have always been driven, as I said earlier, by security. And that security, that mania for security, leads for a deep involvement in the domestic affairs of others. But one thing that I've noticed, whether it's Yemen, whether it's Tunisia, wherever I go in the Middle East, is that when America is seen to be strong, leaders in all these countries are under more pressure to open up their societies so as to satisfy the U.S. Congress, the U.S. President, the various pressure groups in Washington, etc. There's no better recipe for extremism, repression, a bad situation for human rights than a weak American military position in the region.
You're making the case that if we are able to depose Saddam Hussein, what we need to do is to support a liberal dictatorship there as a transitional step to democracy. Do you think the Bush administration shares that opinion? Is that what they're trying to do too?
Well, it might, but you can't put it in those terms. For instance, I can put it in those terms because I'm not a politician. I'm a commentator. But an American politician can never say, I'm going to war for to bring in a liberal dictator. He would say, I'm going to war to bring more freedom, to liberalize a society. And the details of that are best left vague.
And you think that's what the Bush administration is doing, that they're heading for the liberal dictatorship, but they can't quite put it that way?
My suspicion is that what the Bush administration wants is the following, and this is purely my suspicion, is it wants fast and quick a governing authority in Iraq that will get Iraq off the front pages of the newspapers by this summer, say, and move it back to a page three story so that commentators on the op-ed pages can argue then about how fast will it be before there are democratic elections, but swing voters in important states are basically going to consider the issue a success.
You recently went to Colombia, and that will be the subject of your next piece for The Atlantic. Are there any connections between Colombia and the war on terrorism?
Well, you know, Colombia is a bit like the Pacific Theater in World War II. It's jungly, it's crime-ridden, it's violent. There's a whole other war going on there, and yet it's relegated by larger events elsewhere. Colombia is now the third largest recipient of American aid after Israel and Egypt. It has three really brutal terrorist organizations. They are narco-terrorist organizations because you've had extreme right-wing paramilitaries and two left-wing groups that have gone big time into the cocaine business. And it's only a matter of time. In fact, there's already evidence emerging of growing strategic links between Colombian terrorists and Al-Qaeda. After all, Colombian guerrilla groups already have documented links with the IRA, with the Basque separatists in Spain. So Al-Qaeda is really not that much of a jump.
What's the connection?
The connection is pure self-interest. The Colombian terrorists have land to give. They control large parts of the country. Al-Qaeda is looking for places anywhere outside of government control where it can set up some kind of base. Also, the Colombian terrorists have a lot of money. They bring in hundreds of millions of dollars yearly in cocaine-related profits. But they don't have the kind of tactical expertise, the weapons training, etc., that a group like Al-Qaeda has and that it can offer.
Well, Robert Kaplan, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Terry.
Robert Kaplan is a correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. His latest piece on Yemen, Eritrea, and the War on Terrorism is in the April edition. Coming up, we call back Peter Galbraith to talk about the Kurds of northern Iraq and Turkey. This is Fresh Air. On Sunday, the leader of Turkey's governing party was elected to parliament. He's poised to become the next prime minister. He has suggested that he may call for another vote on a plan that was voted down earlier this month, America's plan to use Turkey as a staging ground for U.S. troops who would enter northern Iraq from Turkey. Northern Iraq is where the Kurds have established an independent enclave. Turkey has about 15 million Kurds living within its borders. Turkish leaders are concerned that an independent Kurdish state in northern Iraq might inspire Kurds within Turkey to seek their independence. The Kurds of northern Iraq are worried that their independence could be undermined by the Turks. We've invited back Peter Galbraith, who has worked with the Kurds documenting Saddam Hussein's campaign against them. He's now a professor of national security studies at the National War College in Washington, D.C. He's also the former U.S. ambassador to Croatia. When we spoke in early February, you described yourself as a liberal interventionist, and you said you believe that war was necessary for humanitarian reasons. You were especially concerned about the Kurds, against whom Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons in the late 80s. Now the U.S. is still trying to make a deal with Turkey to let us use Turkey as a base for American troops. Turkey voted it down, but there's still the possibility of reversing that decision. What kind of trouble might it spell for the Kurds if we did use Turkey as a staging ground for troops to enter northern Iraq?
Obviously, it depends on the deal that is struck with Turkey relating to northern Iraq. The negotiations with Turkey have basically had two parts. First, there's been a financial component in which Turkey has been promised $6 billion in grants and another $20 billion in loans. And there has been a political component, which is much less clearly defined, in which Turkey would intervene in northern Iraq, ostensibly for humanitarian purposes. But once there, it would be in a position to potentially to intimidate the Kurdish regional government that is operating in the area. The Bush administration had in February basically capitulated to Turkish demands with regard to the Kurds. In other words, they'd assumed that the Kurds would be kind of the patsies of the situation, that they would go along with whatever the Americans asked of them. And I think they were very surprised when the Kurds said clearly that they did not accept Turkish intervention, and when Barzani, whose territory is along the Turkish border, said that if Turkey comes in, our forces will fight. That being the case, I think the administration has backed off quite a bit. It has taken Kurdish concerns into account. And I think, many people were quite relieved when the Turkish parliament voted down permitting U.S. troops to launch an attack from Turkey into Iraq.
So what might the Turks do if we use Turkey as a staging area for troops to enter northern Iraq?
Well, Turkey does not want to be part of any force that is attacking Iraq, so it doesn't want to be under American command, but it wants to be able to come in some distance into northern Iraq, ostensibly to deal with a flow of refugees. It says that it wants to prevent what happened in 1991 when nearly 500,000 Kurds came to the border of Turkey. But that isn't going to happen this time because the territory in the north is not under Saddam Hussein's control. It is under Kurdish control, and Iraq is not going to be in an attacking mode, so there's nothing that will displace the Kurds from the territory where they now are. So Turkey actually has another motive. I think Turkey believes it can block the future Iraq from becoming a federal state in which the Kurds would have their own region, that it can potentially intimidate the Kurdistan regional government that is based in the north.
So what are the odds, then, that Turkey would enter northern Iraq and try to prevent the Kurds from continuing to have a Kurdish zone?
Well, it is possible Turkey will come in even if there is no agreement on with the United States with regard to American troops staging from Turkey. But I think that is less likely. I think the administration has said clearly to Turkey that if you're not participating in the war effort, then you cannot expect to send your troops into northern Iraq. And even now, I think the administration is very skeptical about permitting Turkey to enter northern Iraq, even if Turkey should change its mind and permit American troops to come into Turkey for the purpose of an attack on Iraq. I think the administration understands that it's going to be very risky to be in a situation in which Turkish troops and Kurdish forces might possibly be fighting each other. That's not going to be consistent with the message that one of the reasons the U.S. is doing this is, in fact, to liberate the Iraqi people.
Well, why did it take some time before the Bush administration reached that conclusion?
The Bush administration's been talking to the Kurdish leaders, and the Kurdish leaders have been very supportive of the war effort. On the one hand, they rather like the situation in which they now live, in which they have de facto independence, protected by the United States and Britain. But they also understand that it's a very precarious situation. They live just across the ceasefire line from Saddam Hussein, whom they associate with the destruction of Kurdish villages, the use of chemical weapons. And so they realize their long-term security is going to be best served by an effort to remove Saddam Hussein and to create a different kind of Iraq. So they have been cooperative. I think the Bush administration assumed that that cooperation would extend to a deal, which the Bush administration was believed as necessary to get Turkey to participate, a deal which allowed Turkey into northern Iraq. I think the administration really didn't understand the depth of Kurdish opposition to Turkish involvement in their own territory.
If Turkey did let the United States use its country as a staging area for American troops, would you still support this war?
Well, I would have grave reservations if the price of Turkish participation was the crushing of Kurdish freedom and of the Kurdish experiment in self-government. It seems to me that the primary justification today for military action is to liberate the Iraqi people from a regime that has committed genocide is absolutely one of the most abhorrent of since the Second World War. And if the price of getting Turkey to participate is crushing the freedom of a part of the Iraqi people, if it is the price is eliminating the only democratic experiment in the entire history of Iraq, which is what the Kurds have in the territory they administer, then frankly I think that price is too high. Because the other case that's been made for the war as of today, really isn't that compelling. That is, the danger from Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. I think that danger was more compelling 6 months ago. But today, with the inspections regime that exists, we can be reasonably confident that Iraq cannot develop nuclear weapons, and that's the weapon of mass destruction that we all have to fear above all others. But to develop them requires large industrial facilities that Iraq cannot hide. And Iraq cannot develop easily more chemical weapons under this system. Now, it obviously still has chemical weapons, it still has biological weapons, but it really can't develop more of them under this kind of inspection system. So in terms of a WMD threat, Iraq is not the number one concern. It obviously pales as comparison, for example, with North Korea.
Well, Peter Galbraith, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, Terry, very good to talk to you again.
Peter Galbraith is a professor of national security studies at the National War College in Washington, D.C. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg traces the evolution of the word protest, as in anti-war protests and pro-war protests. This is Fresh Air. Anti-war protest is a familiar phrase to Americans, but lately a new phrase, pro-war protests, has been used to describe demonstrations supporting the Bush administration's policy toward Iraq. Fresh Air's linguist Jeff Nunberg has these thoughts on the evolution of the word protest.
Sometimes a social change can announce itself in the dropping of a preposition. It used to be that when you used the verb protest to mean object to, you had to add against. She protested against her mistreatment. Then, in the early years of the 20th century, Americans began to drop the preposition and say things like, he protested the government's policy. As it happens, it was around the time that people started using protest with a direct object that they also started to think of protest as a kind of direct political action aimed at mobilizing public opinion against a particular policy. That's when you begin to see phrases like protest demonstration, protest strike, and protest movement. Or take protest march. I had always assumed that the phrase originated with the Ban the Bomb movement of the 1950s. But actually, it was first used in 1913 to describe the march that Gandhi organized to protest the restrictions that had been imposed on the Indian population of South Africa, the first massive civil disobedience campaign. Over the following decades, protest would be intimately linked with those new techniques of political resistance. By the 1930s, people were using phrases like the literature of protest and social protest to suggest the whole range of progressive agitation. But it wasn't until the 60s that the notion of protest entered the mainstream of the American vocabulary. That was the moment when songs with political messages began to make their way out of the coffee houses and hootenannies and onto the airwaves. For some people, protest music evokes the folk-inspired topical songs of Pete Seeger, Joan Baez, Phil Oakes, Country Joe McDonald, and the early Dylan. But by the mid-60s, people were using the phrase for songs like Blowin' in the Wind and Barry McGuire's 1965 Eve of Destruction, which was the first protest song to become a number one hit. Eve of Destruction's lyrics were mostly a generic plea for peace and understanding, a pretty far cry from Phil Oakes' The War is Over or The Fugs' Kill for Peace. Even so, a lot of AM stations refused to play the song, and conservatives complained to the FCC that the song violated the equal time provision, back before they learned they could live nicely without it. By then, people had begun to use the noun protest as a shorthand for a clamorous rally. That gave rise to the word protester, in place of the older form protester, which was derived from the verb. The shift in stress corresponded to a difference in emphasis. Protester suggests an individual with a specific beef in mind, whereas when you hear protester, you think of a bunch of angry people kicking up a row. By the time the Vietnam War ended, the notion of protest was losing its connection with the old tradition of social protest. There's a revealing use of the word in the 1982 film First Blood, the first and by far the best of the Rambo movies. It comes when Rambo's describing his return from Vietnam. "And I came back to the world, and I see all those maggots at the airport protesting me, spitting, calling me baby killer. Who are they to protest me?" Granted, Rambo was supposed to be a little unhinged, but by then a lot of people wouldn't have seen anything odd in the notion of a protest aimed at individual soldiers. It was becoming just another name for a demonstration. That's apparently all the word means to some people now, as protests are back in the streets. The other day, I saw the influential conservative blogger Glenn Reynolds referring to the growing pro-war protest movement. That took me aback, but when I hunted around, I found a number of other conservatives using the word that way. The website of the Young Americans for Freedom boasts about the pro-war protest that the group organized at the University of Michigan. Even the press is starting to pick this up. An article in the Seattle Times last week talked about the protesters at a pro-Bush demonstration who were waving signs saying, "Support our troops." There's a clueless even-handedness in those uses of protest. There's nothing odd in talking about a conservative campus group holding a protest over the university president's support of affirmative action. That may not conjure up the old notion of protest with a capital P, but it's clearly a form of resistance to the established order. But it sounds a little weird to talk about a protest in support of a war that's about to be initiated by the administration in power. Maybe it's just semantic sloppiness, as if protest nowadays was just a question of getting together to yell slogans. Why should the other side have all the fun? Or maybe it's a strategic blurring of historical memory. It's hard to keep this stuff straight in an age when the oldie stations are apt to play Barry Maguire's Eve of Destruction back-to-back with Barry Sadler's Ballad of the Green Berets, which was a number one hit a few months later. But you'd hope that protest would retain some of the sense of resistance that it acquired at the beginning of the last century. Up to now, after all, protest has been the only political action that power can't take.
Jeff Nunberg is currently a fellow at the Stanford Humanities Center. He's the author of the book, The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Franklin Flyer, a novel from Nicholas Christopher, the author of A Trip to the Stars. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, the current state of the Israeli-Palestinian crisis and how it may be affected by war with Iraq. We talk with James Bennett, the New York Times Jerusalem Bureau Chief. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.